Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Tyson Cornell from Rare Bird Lit. I'm here with author Christina McMorris. Her new book is Bridge of Scarlet Leaves, out from Kensington. And she is just getting back from the Tucson Book Fair and had a wonderful time. I was hearing all these great things, listening to some great broadcasts on NPR. Christina, welcome. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened over the weekend?
Yeah, good morning. Oh, gosh, I'm a little bit in a whirlwind. You can probably tell from my voice. This is not my smoky, sexy voice, sadly enough. I wish I could pull this out on command. This is what it sounds like after 5 days of nonstop fun, but craziness at the Tucson Festival of Books. We had such an amazing time. I'm so happy to be able to talk to you about it. We put on some amazing panels while we were there. I was so fortunate to be part of this incredible historical panel that was consisted of myself, Margaret George, who, you know, I think every one of these people I was able to speak to on these author chats over the last few weeks. It was Margaret George, who, of course, is amazing, New York Times bestselling author of a lot of wonderful biographical fiction books that are about, you know, Elizabeth and Mary Magdalene and King Henry VIII, for example. Another one was Jenna Blum, who is the international bestselling author of The Storm Chasers and Those Who Save Us, which is also, of course, a World War II book. And then there was Ruta Sepetys, who's the New York Times bestselling author of Between Shades of Grey, which is one of my all-time favorite novels. And I was such a fangirl, I had emailed her. I don't think I ever shared this with you. This is how Ruta and I met, is because I had emailed her at one point after I read her novel. It's marketed for young adult, but it's so amazing. Everyone should read it. And I finished reading it. I've never done this before. I emailed her and said, I just have to tell you how much I loved your book, blah, blah. And I thought, I'll probably never hear from her again, you know. And an hour later, I got a response saying, oh, my gosh, I'm so excited to hear from you. I've been wanting to read your book, Letters from Home, for so long because a lot of people have told me how much they enjoyed it. So it was this giddy moment for me of, oh, my gosh, she knows my book. You know, and a friendship was born. I'm like, but you're not family or a friend. How do you know of my novel? You're not someone who's obligated to buy. So we ended up hitting it off, and the four of us put together this panel, and we went to the Tucson Festival of Books, and we walked. They told us they were putting us in a larger room than they had planned, and it was supposedly apparently two rooms put together. Now, I imagined when I got there that they must be two small rooms, you know, and clearly I know they're coming for Margaret George and, you know, and Jenna Blum and Ruta. We walk into the back of this room, and it was stadium seating.
Wow.
So we walked in the back. Everyone was facing forward, and they were all seated at these long, those kind of narrow sort of science lab desks in a way.
Sure.
And every seat was filled. There were probably 20 people standing against the wall in the back. I believe they closed the doors and locked them, you know, as far as they wouldn't allow more people in for safety reasons. So we're staring down this long staircase that goes down to the lion's den, essentially, like this table at the bottom that has four microphones, and it's so far down, it's like ants sit down there.
Wow.
And you just think, oh my goodness, do we really have to take this long death walk down to the bottom? And I'm thinking that I'm the only one that's kind of awed by this. I'm thinking, oh, Margaret's used to this, Jenna's used to this. I turn around. All three of them have their cameras out taking photos of the room.
So this is like the full rock star treatment. I mean, authors don't usually get this.
It was amazing, and I was glad to feel like I wasn't alone in how amazing it really was.
Right.
And we sat down there, and we did this panel, and we all spoke for, you know, 10 or so minutes each on each question, and we only got through, you know, about two or three questions because we had so much to say and share about our historical research and our books and how we were inspired to write these and how passionate we are about history.
Well, what do you think the draw was with, why do you think people specifically were so interested in this panel?
Well, Tyson, because of
me. I know. I'm asking you a semi-rhetorical question here, but, you know,
no,
it's like,
not at all.
I, of course, know, but, you know, the people listening to this, I mean, what made this such a such a rock star event for authors?
Yeah. No, of course I'm joking. I think it was the combination of all of us together. I'm thinking Margaret George is, you know, automatically all three of us kind of, you know, Jen and Ruth, and I think it's Margaret, you know, she's brought the crowd.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, other people had come up to me later and said, oh my gosh, you know, Jenna's one of my favorite authors. So I think it was this combination and the fact that we were all similar in that what we write is, you know, we all have very much the same target audience, even if we write in different eras. So I think, I'm not sure exactly what it did, but, you know, maybe the ballroom next door for Lisa C. and Kim Edwards was full, and we got the pour over. I'm not quite sure.
I don't know. I mean, obviously there's some great commonalities in all the subject matter from the books represented on that stage. I can't just blow it off as being coincidence that this is resonating with the general public.
I think you're right, and I think, you know, we've got given that there were three of us also that write World War II, I like to think that maybe that there is something there as well. We got you know, several questions that at the end when we were allowed a short time of Q&A because,
sure,
you know, our time ran up so fast. So much to say, and I, you know, a lot of those questions were about World War II as well, and I think that I could see in the audience, you know, that we had a good number of seniors and elderly people that probably, you know, remember that were either lived through the era or that I think they remember their parents living through the era and vet, you know, fathers who were vets that didn't talk about the war, and I think people are becoming more and more interested in World War II. I hear that so much more often now from readers. That they love World War II books, and I didn't hear that when I first wrote this, you know, my debut novel, and it was more rare to hear that enthusiasm, and now it's coming out more and more.
Yeah.
So I think maybe there's a fascination there, you know, the movies and the music and this generation that we're losing much too fast.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's a little bit of, I hate to use the word nostalgia for a time when people were unified by conflict and whereas now it's the opposite.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Vietnam, there was a draft, and now there's,
right,
you know, a lot of people refer to it as a poverty draft, even though it's a volunteer army. And
yeah,
it's just a different time, and I think that was like the last of the, you know, positive people rallying together for a particular cause.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, the country was so unified at the time. You know, you imagine, you know, people that were, sadly enough, there were guys that committed suicide back in the 40s if they could not qualify to enlist. You know, if they were considered 4F, which was, you know, they had, say, a heart flutter or, you know, an ulcer, anything like that, you know, eyesight wasn't good enough. They were considered 4F. They, you know, there were guys that definitely, yeah, commit suicide because it was the thing to do. You know, it made you patriotic and equal to everyone, and they really wanted to show how much they loved America. And that's definitely, you know, everything. I think also everyone knew what they were fighting for. You know, I think that has gotten confused over the years, ever since Vietnam, and also just the distrust of government, you know, whether right or wrong. And with World War II, I think it was with Pearl Harbor's attack, it became very, very clear what everyone was fighting for. And given that, similar to 9/11, I think we had that same similar feel right after 9/11. I've had vets compare the two, how similar they were in that, you know, being attacked on our own soil. And it was the first time that ever happened.
Yeah.
And so people, you know, were very, very unified. And I think, you know, a little bit makes me sad sometimes that, you know, that the country can be divided so easily over such small things and people, everyone having, in some ways it's so good, everyone has a voice now, you know, and able, feeling like they can make a difference in a lot of ways of, you know, being online and being able to tell people what they think on a platform and be heard. But at the same time, I think that gets abused a bit, and the anonymity of being able to say whatever you want, you know, and not talk about the issues, but instead attacking the people who are also voicing their own opinions. You know, it's sad to me sometimes seeing that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and even with, and we talk about communication and just this instant connection that you have with people all over the world, you know, we didn't really even have that with 9/11.
Right.
Social networking really wasn't
right.
what it is right now.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And like, I went to Iraq in 08, and I was so surprised that my BlackBerry worked in the desert.
Oh, wow. Right.
And it definitely got me thinking just about how,
yeah.
you know, conflict and
yeah.
Just things and everything, of course, that happened in Cairo that was
yeah.
really propelled just by social media.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting now. I mean, I wonder sometimes what my grandmother thinks of all of this because she's, you know, when I say my grandmother, I mean on my mother's side, my maternal grandmother, Grandma Jean, who she was the one who inspired my debut novel, Letters from Home, because of her courtship letters with my late grandfather. And now, as you know, she's so sweet. She's 87 years old. She's very youthful and full of energy and very healthy. And she finally is now on email. And I think it's the cutest thing ever because you get an email from grandma and she hunts and pecks with two fingers, you know. And so, you know, there's sometimes the words are capitalized, sometimes they're not. You know? And you'll get a couple
right.
of lines. And, you know, every once in a while I have to call back to remind her, you know, where to find her inbox and
sure.
and that kind of thing. But I think what she must be thinking of all this, you know, she grew up in an era that, like you said, during the war, you know, in contrast to what you just mentioned, you know, where soldiers now can be overseas and be even FaceTiming, you know, and Skyping
yep.
and
yep.
And texting back to their loved ones, which is such a wonderful thing, where back then they would be writing letters, you know, the era I write in with both my novels, with Letters from Home and Bridges Scarlet Leaves, letters are everything, you know, and you
yeah.
are waiting by the mailbox every day for that mailman when they literally the mailman would come around, you know, and walk the neighborhood and put, you know, your mail through your metal slot in the door and wait to find out, you know, so much importance was put on those letters, not only to hear how they were doing and to have that connection with them, because you had several pages, of course, they oftentimes would fill.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, that was sometimes the sign that they were still alive.
Yeah.
And otherwise you would not know it. You know, you're waiting, hoping a telegram doesn't show up at your door. But that didn't, you know, not everything was efficient during wartime, of course. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, which broke my heart, which I include in my author's note, you know, in Letters from Home, which was that sometimes people would even hear about casualties of their loved ones on the radio first.
Oh, yeah.
And
sure.
so you would sit and listen to the radio every night for the casualty reports. And what a difference that is today. You know, just compare it. And I'm so happy that my grandma kept the letters from my grandfather that inspired this whole thing. But it really made me realize what a lost art writing letters is becoming and the history that is put in those letters that we are really losing today. It's not the same as email. And, you know, I keep saying over and over, but it's so true. Who rereads emails over and over and puts them in a file and goes back to them, passes them along to your children? It's, you know, and
yeah.
Twitter, that's just, you know, we're not passing on 140 meaningful characters these days. So it's kind of
yeah,
sad to see that happen.
I don't know how things are going to be digested, you know. It's going to be really strange, I think, in 20 or 30 years to
yeah.
to not have, well, I mean, maybe it'll be filled, the void will be filled with something different, but, you know,
yeah.
to have that kind of the ability to go back into letters.
Right.
Yeah. It's not the same as text messages from a C-130.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was interesting. I was, speaking of, you know, Tucson Festival of Books, I was on another panel, too, that there was a gentleman named Daniel. He had written this book. Well, I should say, you know, put together, kind of edited, compiled this book because it was all made up of journal entries from his father's diary / journal from the Great Depression. And so he had taken all these, he'd found it, and he had taken these entries and turned it into a book. And it was really fascinating. You know, again, it wasn't a letter, but it was a journal that he had kept about as real time about the Great Depression and going through it and his predictions. And it was interesting about the similarities, you know, and I think you can say about the same about World War II or any tough time in the economy, about how he, going through the double dip and, you know, thinking that the economy was on the rise, and then, you know, he was wrong, and it dipped back down, and so much we can learn, of course, from history, and try, you know, I know obviously economists are definitely studying all of that to try to avoid the same mistakes, but it's interesting to me. I think you can obviously, you know, I know it's a bit cliche, but it's so true that we can learn so much from history, and, you know, I learned so much writing Bridge of Scarlet Leaves just based on that, on history and things I did not know about my own culture. And being half Japanese, my dad being from Kyoto, and I thought that I knew a lot about, you know, the Japanese culture, and, you know, I was really raised in both worlds. And then really come to find out, as I researched more, had so little knowledge of the Japanese American internment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the things I would find out and were, I was, you know, felt fortunate to be able to learn and weave into my novel, I would share with my parents, and my dad was shocked. You know, he had never heard about so many things because he was born just after World War II, and so much of the culture didn't speak about it, and I think that's kind of what we're facing now with, you know, the loss of the greatest generation and the fact that so many of them didn't speak about it, and we can compare the same to World War II, to the Great Depression, to, you know, to Holocaust survivors. So many of these people, you know, there's some shame that comes out of, that is so unjust, that comes out of a lot of these tragedies, and that includes the internment, and also so such humbleness of those past generations. You know, these days everyone wants to talk about everything they do, you know, and we think everything is so exciting, we're going to make a bowl of spaghetti, we got to put it on Facebook, you know, so the whole world knows. But boy, back then, you know, we go to counseling and we get out our feelings, and there's so many healthy things that have come out also. But there's also such a humbleness of those generations of feeling like they did nothing special. Everything is, you know, they were doing what they were supposed to do. So
yeah.
I don't know if you've encountered that with your family at all, with, you know, with your past generations.
Yeah, you know, I did. I got, even going to World War II, I did a lot of research as an undergraduate with my grandfather, who was a paratrooper in W-2. And it was interesting to just to have conversations about that. And he ended up, right after the initial interview I had with him, sending me 3 books that were written by people that he was in combat with that had written about their time and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating to see a whole different side of your family. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's amazing. And so much what I learned from my grandmother, too, when I was going through these letters and interviewing her for the book, you know, not for the book, of course. As you know, I was interviewing her for a biographical section of a family cookbook with her recipes in it. So it was never meant to be a novel. I was never meant to be a novelist. My goodness, I'm still a little bit in a whirlwind of how I ended up here, which is such a great surprise of life. But when I was interviewing her and asking her about her life, about, you know, her time during the Great Depression and during World War II, and sharing these stories that she had that were amazing, that, you know, working as a soda jerk, and I always joke that my kids will have no clue what that means, you know, when you actually had to pour the cherry syrup into the Coke, you know, and mix it up to make a cherry Coke. And she was sharing these great stories about her life and how she had played on a girls' basketball team in high school. You know, and you're thinking back to the 30s and 40s, that was not really necessarily the cool thing to do at the time, to be a girl jock. And she's a little sprite of a thing. I had no idea. My mom was floored. My mom sat there and said, "Grandma, she said, "Mom, you never told me you played basketball in high school." And she said, and of course, the answer is the same, and you know this, from that generation, it's, "Well, nobody asked me."
Yeah.
And you think, what were we thinking? You know, we're so good, I say good as in quote unquote, you know, that we, about sharing everything about our lives today.
Yeah, exactly.
That we forget sometimes we need to be asked when someone's very interested. So it was such a treat, and I have to tell you this was fun. She was sharing some of these stories also on one other occasion, only because it was at the rehearsal dinner for my wedding. My husband and I, his family is from the Midwest as well, and my grandma grew up on an Iowa farm, and his grandparents had also grown up on Iowa farms. So, you know, we always laugh that the common joke in our family is that my husband says everyone has relatives in Iowa that they don't want to admit to. Or some Irish also that we don't want to admit to. Actually,
funny.
Irish, everyone wants to be Irish. So they were seated together. We were about to go to the rehearsal dinner. And, you know, we're running around crazy, grabbing everything. And the grandparents, you know, are just living at a different pace, which, you know, I'm so envious. They're sitting on the couch. They can just, they don't have to be productive and moving at all times. And they're having a nice little chat for the first time ever they'd finally met. And as they're sitting there talking, they came to find out that they, you know, were both from Iowa. And where did you grow up? And where did you go to school? Turns out they lived 10 miles from each other.
That's insane.
And that's when my grandma said, well, oh, I know your high school. I used to go there when I played basketball. And that's part of where we heard some of her stories as well, is because they went to the same dances. They, you know, their sport, the schools played against each other. They were both kind of, I think, one-room schoolhouses, you know, before high school, going up through grade school. And we had no idea. And, the, you know, and my husband's, McMorris, of course, is my married name, in his, or in my grandma's side, if you trace the family tree back, my grandmother's into genealogy, it, eventually the name turns into Morris back in our family line. And so the joke for a little while, you know, which I found much funnier than my husband, was maybe we're cousins, you know. And he didn't really like that. I think he didn't like the thought of our children having, like, three arms or, you know, five ears or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so, but it was a lot of fun, yeah. Anyway, and one thing, too, you know, I was supposed to speak to, I'm going to be speaking to Jean Kwok, who wrote Girl in Translation, and I was going to tell you as we were sitting here chatting, I realized I think our time changed just yesterday. It was yesterday, 2 days ago, right? It's all a blur. But I don't know that she lives in Holland. I'm not sure that her time changed.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. So maybe doing another little radio chat here, possibly, in a little while. I'll have to talk to you about it when we get off the air.
Yeah, definitely.
So anyway, yeah.
Well, yeah, we will definitely connect with Jean, because I want to hear the two of you discuss both of your books for sure, because, you know, I mean, Girl in Translation is really making a lot of waves, I think. And
I think we're going to have a lot in common to talk about with our family backgrounds being Asian and being raised in American culture. So one thing that I will discuss that I have never chatted about on these authors, this, you know, author series, is what I'm working on next.
Oh,
so
yes.
I thought, I don't even know if I've told you this, Tyson. So I just turned in a novella that will be coming out in late October. It's in a holiday anthology, and it will be headlined by Fern Michaels, you know, is a amazing number one New York Times bestseller, and I will write those coattails happily. And so I'm very excited about that, and that, you know, I think my work hopefully will be sampled by a lot of people that otherwise would not know about me, and I think that's thrilling. The novella is titled The Christmas Collector, and all I was told about this that I was supposed to do, I'd never written a novella before. It had to be, you know, my editor told me about 100 pages, and had to be about Christmas. He said, as long as it has lots of Christmas in there, then, you know, then we're good. Just a very heartwarming story. Well, as you know, I write women's fiction. Fern kind of rides the border between women's fiction and romance. And so I thought, gosh, you know, it's hard for me. I have so many good friends that write romance, and they're very good at it. I have a hard time writing the very warm, cozy, you know, I write World War II, so not everything is a happily ever after necessarily. I believe very strongly in hopeful endings. And for me, that's even, you know, that touches my heart, because I feel like that was the epitome of World War II. How you survive that, of course, through all the tragedies and the loss and hardships, is hope. And I think for me, I hope that resonates with readers when they read my work, in that no matter what hard time we're going through, even now in tough economies, there's always hardships in life. And as long as you can hold on to hope, you can get through it. You know, and I hope that people will read the book and think, if they can get through it, so can I. You know, and if they if that's what they learn from it, that means a lot to me. So when I sat down to write this novella, I thought, okay, I'm going to try really hard to incorporate Christmas. And I told my husband, about what I came up with and that I was finally on a roll and I knew what I was going to write. I knew who these characters were. I knew what the story was. And because I usually have worked backward, I usually have the nugget of the idea and then write my story. And then I'm on deadline versus you're on deadline, come up with a story. Dance, monkey, dance is what I always call it at home. Dance. So I'm thinking, oh gosh, okay, I got to come up with a story. So I came up with this story. I told him about a Jenna Matthews, who her name is her name. She's a estate liquidator because her mother was a former hoarder. So it's cathartic for her. She hates Christmas with a passion.
Wow.
She is Scrooge. You know, she doesn't, it feels good to her to get rid of other people's junk. So you can imagine what Christmas is for her. It's the exact opposite. It's people buying junk for each other, of, you know, expensive junk that a year from now it will be in a yard sale for 25 cents, and she will have to clean up and dust off and try to sell at an estate sale. And so she really hates Christmas with a passion. She comes across an elderly woman's shoebox as she's cleaning out this woman's house who is moving into the mother-in-law quarters of her son's home because the house is, she's a widow and the house is too big for her to take care of anymore. And so Jenna finds the shoebox of this woman. She assumes it must have been put in the garbage by accident because it has pictures from World War II in it of this woman, the elderly woman, as a young woman serving in a hospital in World War II, and it's got the Bronze Star in here. It's got some amazing, you know, memorabilia. She brings it to the woman and says, you know, even though she'd rather just throw everything in life away, she lives so sparsely, she comes to the woman and says, I think this was a mistake. I'm sure this is meant to keep and not to be thrown out in donations. And the woman opens the box and becomes very emotional over what she's seen. And like you said, the word, you know, very nostalgic over this. And she then closes the box and says, throw it all away. Get rid of it. Take it out of my house. It's meaningless. And so it raises all of these questions about what people value and why we value things. And so much about, of course, that she doesn't realize yet is that why we value things more often than not is because of the memory attached to it.
Yeah.
That is the perception. That's why, you know, and that's why a trinket can mean more than something that costs thousands of dollars to us. And it's, you know, it's because of the memory attached to it. And so she hasn't learned that yet. And the older woman's family has no idea about this woman's past. They don't know about grandma's past and that she served in the Women's Army Corps. And as that secret is, you know, coming out in the family, and as Jenna can't help herself but start to investigate a bit about this woman, it ends up really changing a lot of the lives in this woman's family as well. And all of that in 100 pages.
Wow. Was it hard writing in shorter form for you?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was a little nerve-wracking knowing I had a page count that I couldn't go past. I'm not used to that. You know, Bridge of Scarlet Leaves, as you know, is quite a long book because it covers 5 years, the entire World War II for the U.S.
Sure.
So with this one, I kept thinking every day, like, oh, gosh, you know, I can't go over. I have so much to say because, once again, I was warned, when you write a novella, from a good friend of mine who's very good at them, she said, no subplots. You keep everything very simple. You know, you've got to keep, you know, 1 to 2 points of view, you know, like you really keep it pretty limited. And then there's me, I come in, I'm putting in, I'm like, well, I only have 4 subplots. I hope that's okay. I just can't do that because I think it's easier to do that when you have a romance where you're really majorly following one love story and everything else is a little bit extra. With my stories, I can't help myself. My stories are about relationships. They are about family relationships. And even if in any love relationship and romantic relationship, it's coming from somewhere. Our issues come from somewhere. And more often than not, it's because it comes from our family. And they're all dysfunctional in some way. So,
yeah, right, exactly.
So we're all working out our issues in that way. So, yeah, so that's to sum it up. That's called The Christmas Collector. And it's coming out in the anthology is titled A Winter Wonderland, which is very fun. So I'm curious to see what that cover looks like, which we should see
great.
Soon. And
pub's in October?
It is, the very end of October. So it's kind of a November release because it's for Christmas. And the one important thing I will mention is that the elderly woman is a young woman who serves in the Women's Army Corps in Letters from Home. She's a minor character. So I'm really hoping that people who enjoyed Letters will then hopefully enjoy this novella. They're kind of, you know, they're not, it's not like a series, but they are definitely strongly connected. And so I think it'll be fun for people who read the novella to hopefully go back and read Letters from Home and see this woman, not as her memories, but when she really lived through it.
Yeah, I love when non-mystery writers connect their characters. You know, and I encourage it with authors as much as possible. Especially when they're veering away from it, when they're like, oh, no, that's too much like my other book.
Right.
No, I think, you know, bringing them together and kind of continuing that thread is totally natural.
Yeah,
and,
it's fun.
I've seen a lot more of it with general fiction and literary fiction.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of a wink to the readers too, is what I like to think of it. You know, the ones that go, oh, I get it, and they feel. I think it's a little bit of an inside, you know, kind of you're on the inside bubble, or you know, the inside joke of understanding that these are connected, even if nobody else understands that. And I did do that, by the way. I know we're running out of time, but I will mention I did do that with Bridge of Scarlet Leaves, and that there is, and I put it in the discussion questions in the back so that people can go back and go, oh, that's who they were, you know, because it's very easy to miss. I put a very brief cameo in Bridge of Scarlet Leaves since the part of the story will take place on a farm in Illinois, and there are some characters from Letters from Home who are from a farm in Illinois.
Great.
And although the characters only talked about in Letters from Home, they're relatives of some of the main characters, they do show up in Bridge of Scarlet Leaves for one scene. And it just coincidentally, I put them in the same place, and I thought, oh, well, why can't they show up? I thought that would be kind of fun. So it's one of those things that most people I thought might miss, but hopefully, you know, the ones that catch it, I think, would really enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely. Some of my favorite things, you know, reading multiple works from a particular author is feeling like you're on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that, you know, hopefully it bonds the reader more to the story, and you have more of a personal connection investment in it. So hopefully they'll feel that way about my books. So people listening, I hope you enjoy both my novels. I know we got to wrap things up. So it's, like Tyson said, Letters from Home. It's my debut, and my brand new shiny toy is called Bridge of Scarlet Leaves and involves a love story set during World War II, but is complicated by the Japanese-American internment, where you have a Caucasian woman who follows her Japanese-American husband into Manzanar War Relocation Camp, and everybody is trying to search for their identity and figure out where their loyalties lie.
Yeah, it's a very interesting historical fiction title. Contrary to the pink on the cover, it's not just a title for women.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed the book.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sure a lot of other guys out there will too. But next time, we're going to bring in Jean Kwok, author of Girl in Translation.
Right.
And then we'll continue the discussion.
That sounds good. Yeah, I think she and I will have some very funny family stories. So
definitely.
Looking forward to that. All right.
Well,
thank you so much, Tyson.
Thank you, Christina. You have a wonderful day.
You too. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.